Fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety, and those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force with your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors, leaders, and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is brought to you by Five Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission. First responders helping each other. And our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, your best bet for fire service tick training. The Firehouse Tribune, where you can expand your horizons in emergency services and learn to work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes. And our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Thin Red Line Decon Products, making decontamination as simple as possible for you with decon wipes, shampoo, body wash, and more. Haas Alert, creator of the safety cloud for our roads. Fry Guy Levers and Nestor Bars, the amazing new hand tools for the fire service. Silver Arrow Coaching and Consulting, unlock your potential from burnout to brilliance. Crackle Magazine, serving the International Fire Service. EFT Corporation, 40 plus years of innovation in donation and payment processing solutions. Health KPI, teaching you how to track the right data to stay at the top of your game. The Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004. The Firefighter Cancer Support Network. The Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those earphones or turn up those speakers. The Five Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force. I'm your host, Steve Green, happy to be here with you, and happy to have you here with us. We have a very special podcast for you today. My guests are Chief Brian Fennessy, the Chief of the Orange County, California Fire Authority, and Retired Assistant Chief Scott Jones, who served with Los Angeles County Fire Service, and we'll be discussing their QRF program. We'll tell you all about that in just a few moments when they join us. And if you listen to this podcast on our website, well, we hope you'll look around the website, you'll enjoy what you see, and while you're there, you can also find on our podcast library all our audio episodes since we started the podcast way back in 2016. All you have to do is go to our homepage at www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. And across the horizontal menu, select the word called podcast, and that'll take you to our library. And you can listen to as many as you'd like. Just remember to take out some time for bathroom breaks and eating. Now, while you're on the website, we hope you also may want to sign up for our newsletter. We send it out only about 4 times a year. We just sent out the one for the end of the year. And it tells information about the podcast, our nonprofit, of course, which is very, very important to us, especially now with the holiday time, and other details about what's going on here at Five Alarm Task Force Corp. and the podcast. All you have to do is just sign up for the newsletter. Should you ever wish to unsubscribe, all you have to do is send us an email to the email address dalmatprod, all one word, D as in Delta, A-L-M-A-T, P as in Peter, R-O-D, at outlook.com. And please put the word unsubscribe in the subject line, and we will remove your name just as soon as we receive your wish. We want to send our thanks and our great gratitude and appreciation to all our friends on Facebook. The numbers keep increasing. Thank you for all the comments. Thank you for sharing. We hope especially a podcast like this episode will really pique your interest, as they say, and I think you're going to enjoy it. But thank you for your unwavering support all these years for the podcast. Now, many of you listen to our podcast on podcast platforms, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Podcast, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, whatever. Most of those platforms allow you to leave either a star rating or a couple of sentences for a comment. Now, that's very important, not just to those of us here at Five Alarm Task Force, but to every podcaster who's out there broadcasting. And that's the reason is because those reviews, whether you have good ones or bad ones or none at all, are part of the algorithm that the platforms use in their search engines. So if someone comes looking for our podcast, for example, maybe they don't know where to find us, but they search for it. Well, I think we have a pretty unique name. Nevertheless, we only have a few ratings after 7.5 years. That takes a toll on us in these search engines for all the main podcast platforms. So if you could take a moment, please, and just leave either a star rating or a couple of nice words. And listen, if you need to write constructive criticism, please do. We need to hear that so we can bring you the programs, the type of programs, and the guests that you would like to listen to. But that will be a big help to us, and we really appreciate that. And that's it. That's our business for today. So we're going to be right back right after these words with our guests from California as we talk about the QRF, what it is, how it works, and why it works. We'll be right back. As always, please stay tuned. New technology for the fire service seems to appear almost every day, and that technology demands a learning curve, especially if we're talking about thermal imaging cameras. That's where Insight Fire Training LLC is your best bet. With an excellent reputation across the U.S., Insight Fire Training will meet all your TIC training needs. Their curriculum is peer-reviewed and has been used internationally. Their instructors are Level 1 Thermography Certified, and they have taught in 33 states and 4 countries. Their courses run from introductory to training the trainers. Courses are available online, for the classroom, classroom hybrid, and even live fire. Insight Training LLC is proficient in over 40 thermal imaging cameras, so you feel confident they will know your make and model. Best of all, programs are customized to your specific needs, and their cadre of fire service veterans are vetted craftsmen of Project Kill the Flashover. They are so proficient that they have trained TIC manufacturers on how to best use and sell their own product. That's Insight Fire Training LLC. Look them up on InsightTrainingLLC.com. Your best bet for TIC training. Would you like to meet up with Andy and the team from Insight Training LLC? Well, here's part of their upcoming schedule. December 15th and 16th, Insight Training LLC will provide a 2-day thermal imaging hands-on training course sponsored by Beaver Lane Fire and Rescue and will be hosted at the SPCC Training Center in Monroe, North Carolina with instructors Andy Starnes and Tim Mills on Friday, December 15th from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. and all day Saturday, December 16th, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. This course will cover their introduction to tactical thermal imaging and spend intensive training on the application of those concepts. This course includes demonstrations and active classroom participations that is customized to the host organization's needs. Friday will consist of a 2-hour classroom training, followed by an orientation burn to introduce the students to the concepts they learned in the classroom. Saturday will consist of the following live fire demonstrations: tactical 360, thermal rebound and fire attack drill, enhanced search methodology drill. For details and registration, please visit the Insight Training LLC website. On December 19th, Tactical Thermal Imaging International Spanish Webinar, Insight Training instructor Andrew Starnes will be providing a webinar that will be translated into Spanish on December 19th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. This clinic includes a certificate of instruction provided by the host organization. Instructor Andy Starnes is a specialist and international reference in training in the use of thermal imaging cameras. Again, that is on December 19th. Please see the flyer for details. And finally, January 12th through the 14th in 2024, Insight Training LLC is proud to sponsor the second annual Country Roads Fire Conference in West Virginia for 2024. This event will be held on January 12th through the 14th Insight Training instructors will be at this event, and Andy Starnes will be providing a behavioral health program designed for first responders called The Ultimate House Fire, yours. Check out their Facebook page. Or remember, please be sure to check the website InsightTrainingLLC.com or their Facebook page for registration and additional details. Insight Fire Training LLC, your best bet for fire service. Tick training. The Firehouse Tribune has expanded, now bringing you podcasts, presentations, and training blogs. The Firehouse Tribune is an innovative way for emergency services professionals to interact, share ideas, learn, and train. We are inspired by those who came before us and built the path for us to share knowledge and experience with the rest of the emergency services world, where life experiences and training come together. Check out our podcasts, Station Talk, and the 5-Tool Firefighter Podcast. Want us to speak at your department or event? Reach out to us to set up workshops at your firehouse or virtual event on topics including the 5-Tool Firefighter, 5 key attributes of the well-rounded firefighter, and 6 tips to guide the new fire officer. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. For more info, please visit www.firehousetribune.com or email us at fhtribunepodcast@gmail.com. The new Firehouse Tribune Services, where we live by one motto, not just in emergency services, but in life. Excellence is a habit, not a goal. We're firefighters. We're law enforcement. But like everyone else, we have our aches and pains, sometimes from the job and sometimes not. We realize there are risks with this job. However, sometimes something is wrong with us and we don't know it. Now what do? Well, LifeScan Wellness Centers are dedicated to saving America's heroes. For most fire and police organizations, LifeScan Wellness Centers will send one of their mobile teams to assess every member of your department with complete and complex physical exams and blood work. Using state-of-the-art medical equipment, LifeScan staff members provide a multi-procedural exam, including cardiac stress tests, basic lab results, and ultrasound exams. LifeScan Wellness exams have saved the lives of dozens of firefighters and police officers across the country. They have found tumors, aortic bulges, lung problems, and more, many of which were asymptomatic. However, early detection allowed most of these colleagues to have their personal medical professionals mitigate the health issue that otherwise might have led to a darker time. For more information, please visit their website at lifescanwellness.com. Remember, LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes. If you like a good firefighting conference where you can learn, you can share, you can teach, and you can enjoy, well, the North Florida Fire Expo is the place to be. It is an affordable, unapologetically blue-collar fire conference for firefighters who are hungry to learn and improve. Our mission is to passionately pursue excellence through authentic blue-collar training. Come celebrate the 5th year anniversary, February 7th through 10th, 2024, on the beautiful beaches of Okaloosa Island, Florida. For more information, check out their website at www.NorthFloridaFireExpo.com. Again, that's www.NorthFloridaFireExpo.com. You don't want to miss it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Five Alum Task Force. If you're watching the video, if you're listening to the audio, you heard our introduction. My name is Steve Green. I'm your host. Happy to be here with you. Happy to have you here with us. And we have a really special podcast today. And it's based on a TV show, a reality show called Smithsonian Channel. And a couple of weeks ago, I saw this story that they ran on their series called The Mightiest. And it dealt with the QRF program with Orange County Fire out in California. And also, as I learned subsequent to that, I saw LA County is part of that as well. And so I reached out, I did some research online because I saw his name on the show. This is Chief Brian Fennessy. And I reached out to him through LinkedIn. He was kind enough to not discard my message and reply to me. And we put this together. And I'm so glad to have both of you today. First, I'll give you a background on Chief Fennessy. As the fire chief of Orange County Fire Authority, Chief Fennessy leads more than 1,700 firefighters and non-sworn personnel who collectively serve 2 million residents across 23 cities and unincorporated areas. Chief Fennessy began his career in 1978 with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's United States Forest Service and the U.S. Department of Interior's Bureau of Land Management, working as a hotshot crew member and ultimately crew superintendent. Now, if you don't know what a hotshot crew member is, think of what you've seen on the news about with all these fires of the men and women on the ground and those who actually parachute in as well to fight the fires that we have been seeing such a strong growth in over the last 10 years or so here in our country. In 1990, Chief Fennessy joined the San Diego Fire Rescue Department and ultimately became the chief of that department in 2015. In 2018, he was appointed to fire chief of the Orange County Fire Authority. As chair of the FireScope Board of Directors, Chief Fennessy is an advisor to the director of the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services. Currently serves as a member of the International Association of Fire Chiefs and Western Fire Chiefs Association, Wildland Fire Police Policy Committee. He serves as the sponsoring agency chief's representative for the 9 West Division FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Task Forces and president-elect of the California Fire Chiefs Association. In 2022, Chief Fennessy was recognized as Cal Chiefs Fire Chief of the Year, and in 2023, the International Association of Fire Chiefs Career Fire Chief of the Year. Chief Fennessy, welcome and congratulations on these well-merited awards.
Thank you, Steve.
Also joining us this morning is Assistant Chief, retired Assistant Chief, Scott Jones of LA County Fire and Rescue. Chief, can you tell us a little bit about your background in the fire service?
Sure. My background started in 1963 as a volunteer firefighter, just like you mentioned you started. And I stayed with that for over 20 years, but in the process that was able, got hired by a nearby municipal fire department. So I did both jobs at the same time. Spent 2 years there, went to Los Angeles County, where I served as, you know, a typical municipal positions, firefighter, firefighter, paramedic. I worked on engines and trucks. And then I got interested in the wildland community, and I went into that starting in 1984, and it became quite a focus of mine. I stuck with it and actually stayed in that, we call it Air and Wildland Division for Los Angeles County Fire Department until I was retired in 2005 as the Air and Wildland Division Chief. So I worked all the positions like Chief Fennessy's. I was on hand crews and worked as battalion chief and then as the assistant chief for that. Post-retirement, 2005, I went back to Los Angeles County and was hired on to do wildland training and mentoring of newer members coming up to the organization, and did that until June of this last year. And then really put my focus back on the quick reaction force, the QRF that we're working on and talking about today, about three years now we've been in that program. So that's my history.
Great. Thank you very much. And as I was talking to Chief Fennessy before we started recording, I talked about the old show, you know, Emergency. And if you who are watching this or listening to this episode, if you're an aficionado of Emergency, as I have been for over the 50 years that since it's been on, is that you've seen they specialized on several different episodes of Emergency, major fires in the Los Angeles County area. And while, you know, Roy and Johnny were actors playing in that, the fact is they used real footage from some of these fires. And so many people who don't live in the California area know these crazy wildfires from news stories over the years. But I don't think most people understand the challenges that you face. And what I want to get to is, with those challenges in mind, how the QRF program was created. I learned it from the episode, but on Smithsonian, but I think I'd like them to know what I learned, because I think it's unique and it's probably one of the most, one of the strongest forward steps that the fire service has taken in quite a while. As we joked before, the two things that firefighters hate the most are status quo and change. And so how do we make these kind of changes and get our people to buy into it and how important it is? Because without them, none of it works. But with everybody on board, I've seen the large dents that you've put in to the problem in your two areas. So let's talk a little bit about how the QRF concept was born.
You bet. And I will tee it up here for Chief Jones in a second. But, you know, we, and you're right. I mean, between L.A., Orange, Ventura, Southern California, San Bernardino, you know, we've experienced large, you know, wildfires for decades.
Right.
And, you know, the communities have built up and actually are living in these mountainous communities up into places where perhaps in the 40s, 50s, whatever, were open spaces. Well, now they're full of communities. And, you know, our mission obviously is life and property. And so we find even on small, you know, what we would consider small vegetation fires, life and property at risk just about every time, you know, we go out the door. And then when the wind blows, you know, we have the Santa Ana winds here in Southern California, all bets are off. Depending on where the fire ignites and how it's lined up or aligned, as we like to say, we can and have lost, you know, hundreds of homes and many lives. And so it's become more complex, I think, here in Southern California, again, because of the population. A bit different than other parts of the country. I like to say that, you know, Southern California is probably more well-resourced than any, you know, place maybe on the globe. But our fires, especially under wind conditions, you know, can travel miles and we see that, you know, all the time. And so when we need help like now, you know, help coming in 12 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours, it doesn't help us. And so, you know, between the three counties, Ventura County is also a member of the QRF. You know, there's an estimated 2/3 of the population of California is in those three counties. Wow. And so between the three fire departments and LA City, we have a lot of resources to bear. The program really started, I want to say initially, it wasn't QRF, but in 2019, was approached by Southern California Edison as a utility company, power company, and the second largest here in the state of California. And again, because we've built up in the canyon areas, you know, we're seeing, you know, power line ignited fires really doing a lot of damage, where perhaps, again, decades ago, was more open space and we didn't see that kind of damage. Well, of course they get, you know, there's litigation, they get sued. And as we've said for probably the last 20 years, maybe plus, is, you know, this fire problem in Southern California, it's not just a fire department problem. It's a community problem. It's a, you know, the citizens own a piece of it, the utilities, I mean, everybody owns a piece of it, and we just need to live, you know, learn to live better with fire is what we say. And so, you know, credit to the power company, they approached me in Orange County because I had a program with a power utility company in San Diego and wanted to invest money in, you know, whatever program we thought made sense. And so initially it was really two helicopters, one large helicopter, CH-47 Chinook, and a command and control platform here to serve all of their service area, 15 counties, but really primarily here in Orange County. It was very successful in 2021. We had a number of, maybe it's 2020, we had a number of fires here in Orange County that became large, and these aircraft are flying day and night. And in talking with my counterparts at LA County and Ventura County, you know, we thought, wow, they were really interested in how, you know, they might also participate. And so this is where I'm going to turn it over to Chief Jones. We We've gathered a small group of people at one of the bases, and we were talking about perhaps what the future could look like, and largely, how we've all experienced fires that, either initially or at some point during the initial phase of the fire started to escape. And that, boy, had we had, surge, had we had a few more of these or a few more of that, we might have stopped that fire from burning several days and burning structures. And so it was really a conversation. I'll kick it over to Chief Jones, because really he was the one that really put it into context, I think, for all of us. And I really credit him for having the vision. So, Chief, why don't you take it?
Well, you might find this an unusual and interesting context to the discussion here, in that as a volunteer fireman, I mean, part of how I arrived at thinking about this QRF, Quick Reaction Force idea, came from my days as a volunteer fireman. And as the volunteers were, the community I was in had a bunch of small vehicles, actually Jeeps from World War II that had been converted, had tanks in them, didn't hold a lot of water, but they were spaced throughout the community. And the whole idea was to, when the call came in, was for the farmers and ranchers to jump on those Jeeps and get there as fast as they could. And in watching it from the 23 years I was a volunteer, there was a limit to their abilities, because they just didn't have time to train in great detail. So what worked was get there fast, put the fire out fast. And if that didn't work, the county fire department would eventually arrive, because in those days they were stationed a long ways away. There weren't a lot of stations. And then they would bring the higher level of professionalism into the fire and so forth. But it was that quick reaction by the local volunteers on those fire jeeps with minimal training that was proved very successful. So moving ahead to indexing to what we're talking about here this morning, also I'd worked in the Air and Wildland Division for a lot of years. And one of the things that we were deficient on was having a good aerial supervision platform for the three counties. Now, the aerial supervision platforms take a long time to develop. There's a lot of training and experience that the individuals that become HELCOs and air attacks have to go through. And it was very difficult for the local government agencies, LA County, Ventura, and Orange County, to have quality persons like this, qualified persons like this on duty, and to have a helicopter they could afford to put up as a supervision instead of drop of water, because we needed to drop water in the fire. So I had always thought about having some form of aerial supervision available to share between the three counties, so that the water dropping helicopters could stay focused on putting the fire out and still have aerial supervision to help make it safe. So the other thing that came along that made a change, or was, a seed that was planted, was the helicopter that we have access to now, the Coulson CH-47. It's very unique. It has a unique tanking system. Its capabilities is just awesome, just absolutely awesome. So Chief Fantasy was the one that put that together. But when I got to thinking about how to resolve this issue, he proposed that Edison was willing to work with us. It just made it real easy in my mind, give each community a helicopter and share the aerial supervision, and then work with each other on a very rapid deployment concept. And that was how I saw it in my mind. It's stealing a military acronym of the Quick Reaction Force. It's a force available to reinforce, patrols that are out on are being taken by overtaken by fire. They quickly move that force over to reinforce them. So that's basically what we did here. Is we just took the new capability, those three big helicopters, and an aerial supervision platform, Edison sponsoring it, and split them up between the three counties. And that's mostly Chief Fennessy's side of the story here. He was the one behind it. I just had a little light bulb, and he took it and ran with it, as he does with everything else.
Well, it sounds like the light bulb was well worth exploring because of what you're able to do today and the example that this Tri-County organization stands for and can show to other departments that you can't, you may not be able to do it to this level, but if you put your minds to it and you get people to join with you. And I think kudos to California Edison for doing that and reaching out. We've seen, unfortunately, on the news the last few years, the number of these fires caused by downed lines. We know even the Maui fire is now, it was created through a power line, program, a problem. So, you know, people are aware of that, but again, that's a microcosm of the picture, because this kind of stuff, as we just said earlier, is not just in Southern California anymore. We're seeing it. Alaska had major fires this year. The southeast of the U.S. had major fires this year. We were just talking before you logged in about the there was a posting last week that New Orleans firefighters are asking for training in fighting bog and swamp fires because they had a bunch of them this past summer. And they went through hell trying to contain them and put them out and stuff like that. And so, and we've seen it in Canada. We saw it in Israel. We saw it in Greece again this year. And I think that if the way you, both of you have explained just the origins of it, I think could be that the first chapter of the playbook for other departments to think of, how can we take this concept and customize it for our area? We don't have, like, we're not having the power companies coming in and saying to us, approaching us first and saying, how can we help you? But the fact is that perhaps with what we can learn today, that departments can go to their power companies, they can go to a regional association and see how they can work together and, you know, get over the, you know, we've all seen the stuff on social media, stuff about, well, I'm not going to respond and work with that company, that fire department, because they don't do it. I don't like, it's just a matter of personalities. And when we take that oath, there's nothing in there about we can choose who and what we're going to do it for. If you're going to be a firefighter and you take an oath to protect your community, the lives and property of that community, then you have to do what you can do to do that. And you can't make excuses. And I think that this concept, and that was the first thing I thought of when I was watching the Smithsonian program, is that this could be something contagious in a good way. People needed to see this in the fire service, not only just the citizens, but our colleagues, whether they're retired or still active, need to see how unique and how an idea like this can come up and go from taking, as you said, the military idea of a quick reaction force, and we can apply it to fire protection and mitigation in our communities. So let's go from the starting level to the next issue. So we started off with the Edison coming and offering to participate financially and to assist. Again, I think that's unique because most of the time we don't hear of stories like that. So once you started it, where did it go? How did it, once you guys, you had the meetings, the committee, everyone's on the same page, how did it go there? And how, like, besides the money from the power company, how did you get more money to help you with the costs of the QRF amongst the three counties?
So, you know, and I'll go back a little bit to what you just mentioned. I think, you know, well, that still exists within the fire service. There tends to be boundaries, let's just say. I think, you know, because of the disasters that we've experienced here, and certainly Florida is no different. Florida, right. Texas, California, you know, we've really learned that these problems are regional in nature. I mean, and it's really the chiefs from the four large agencies have always been close, but I think it's brought us much closer. I mean, to this day, we have a weekly, myself, the chief of LA City, LA County, and Ventura County, we have a half hour every Wednesday morning where we get up on a call, and sometimes it's just to talk about anything. It got us through COVID. Hey, what are you doing? Your staffing issues. But we have this close relationship that allows us to move resources outside the standard mutual aid system, meaning, and that is a system that unfortunately is a very slow system. That the mutual aid system here in California, well, the best and probably the most robust in the world, it's not built for speed. It's built to, the system is built to track resources and for reimbursement, but not speed. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, we have a need for speed here. A couple hours, everything's over and done. So we've developed even our own, for lack of a better word, mutual aid system, where it's literally pick up the phone and, hey, you know, if you need 20 engines, just call me, tell me where you want them, and they're on the road in 5 minutes. We'll let the system catch up with, you know, how we're reacting. But that is very novel. You can imagine that those that manage the processes and systems weren't real happy with us about that. But at the end of the day, you know, in our view is how do you not, you know, the public expects, you know, that we, and I think Chief Jones said it very well. I mean, we've got to be fast. It's got to be quick here in Southern California. And I'll reemphasize what you said, Steve. It's no longer a Southern California problem. I mean, this time of year used to be 20, 30 years ago. The only place there were fires would be this time. I mean, as we sit here today with Southern California, it's not the case anymore. There are fires occurring year round. They occur all months of the year here in Southern California. And while I get that some people would like to argue about the climate change thing, I tend to believe it because we are living it, I think, right, every day. Chief Jones just managed as the program coordinator. He just spent 3 days in Ventura County on a 3,000-acre fire where the QRF was used at night. And I think where we go from now, and one of the things that I'm pushing on, I speak at a number of national conferences and others, is I'm really pushing to encourage probably the largest, you know, natural resource agency in the business, in the fire business, the Forest Service, to do more. You know, what we're doing is not high tech. I mean, night vision goggles, you know, LA County, Orange County, we've been flying at night fighting fire for decades. The Forest Service, on the other hand, is one night capable helicopter. It's a medium helicopter based out of, I think, Fox Field in the backside of the Angeles National Forest in LA County. They've had that for, gosh, I don't know, maybe close to 20 years. They really haven't expanded the program. Meanwhile, you know, the counties down here, Orange, we operate several helicopters, LA County, of course, Ventura, LA City, and we're doing this. And so by operating these large helicopters, I mean, our helicopters are dropping anywhere, agency helicopters, anywhere between 350 and 1,000 gallons. These Chinooks are dropping 3,000 gallons. You know, the tanks that are in these, and Chief Jones mentioned it, the tanks that are in these aircraft, you know, are very high tech. They are the same tanks that are going in the Coulson C-130 air tankers, the identical tank. We're dropping an air tanker, fixed wing air tankers worth of product with every drop. And so I think the focus for us largely has been the night availability. Typically, you know, during the day, you'll see fixed wing air tankers dropping, you know, the pink, you know, phos-check or retardant on these fires. But as soon as it gets dark, then they go away. And even when they're operating, they got to return to a tanker base, right, that's set up. They've got to land. They've got a taxi. They've got to get filled. They got to taxi back out. And they got to launch. So your turnaround times between drop and returning for another drop can be fairly extensive. One of the tools that we have as part of the QRF is called a mobile retardant base, an MRB. Perimeter Solutions is the company that's providing the retardant. Well, they also provide these mobile retardant bases. It literally looks like a carnival when it's going down the road, but it's semi-trucks with, you know, large, look like swimming pools and chemicals. And anyways, Chief Jones can get into it a little bit more, but, you know, they'll set up very quickly, quickly being a relative term, in close proximity to the fire to mix, to batch mix this retardant, the same retardant you're seeing the fixed wing air tankers drop. And so literally with these helicopters, we can apply more retardant because these tanks, they're hover filling, right? So they go over to the tank, they can snorkel up that 3,000 gallons of retardant, drop it on the fire and quickly come back and get another 3,000 gallons. Nobody's doing that at night anywhere in the world. That's what makes this, you know, unique right now. I think what we'd like to see in the future is the Forest Service and others that contract these aircraft to really get serious and look at, you know, large helicopters dropping retardant at night. If you can imagine a system, whether it's the state or throughout the West, where you have multiple MRB, mobile retardant bases staged, so that when you do get these fires, they're on the road, they're on the move, along with the helicopters, and now you're starting to apply retardant at night. There's no reason we shouldn't be dropping retardant at night once those fixed-wing air tankers go away. And Scotty, I mean, you can certainly fill in any blanks.
Yeah, well, that's a big advantage, and we, you know, we see it here. What's connected to the MRB that makes it so important is the retardant is basically a fertilizer designed and developed by Foscheck years ago. And what it does, it slows the fire down. So you put it on, water knocks it down, but water doesn't hold fire, right? So if it's on a hot, windy day or hot, windy night, they drop the water and it'll sit there for quite a while. But when the wind finally dries it out, and there's one little ember in there, it takes off again. So in perimeter control on big wildland fires, we're dependent on checking the, excuse me, sorry about that, folks.
That's okay. No worries. Yeah,
something I hadn't considered. So on wildland fires, we depend on doing the perimeter control and then follow up immediately with hand crews. And it always takes boots on the ground too.
Right.
All the firefighters listening out there, never think this is replacing you, because we just check it until we give you time to get there and start putting your hand lines in or hose lines. It's still the fundamental end of a fire is always boots on the ground. So by using retardant, the reason we're trying to really maintain that standard is that it gives the incident commander time to get resources in place so that we can move those folks up into the terrain and finally complete those lines. And retardant, sometimes retardant is really all that you need. It would go hide on its own, but we always follow up in this region here with a hand line to mineral soil, and that takes time. So that's how we came up with really pushing to use the mobile retardant base. And it's mobile, and we key to that is we have pre-selected locations that are approved for use, and you know it's okay for us to go there and set up. So the trucks drive out there, and the guys takes them a couple hours to set it up, but it's pretty amazing. Nobody's doing this. This has never been tried before. So you know, we're learning as we go along.
Sure.
What challenges there are, but we're getting it done. And so far, every fire that we've gone to at night where they've wanted retardant, we've been able to set it up, and by the next morning, there's been no fire. So that's kind of, in my mind, a testament to the concept, that part of it. Everything we're doing needs a little massaging, a little work, but that's the idea behind the dropping retardant at night on these fires. Is we have to give the commanders time to put people in place to finish off the fire line.
All right. And I think a lot of our listeners will be able to understand that, especially those in rural areas who use tankers and drop tanks. Sure. You know, something I never even heard of until I got to that little department in North Carolina. We put in dry hydrants throughout our response district, and we had tankers, we had the drop tanks, and it's the same thing. We set up, when you don't have water at the scene, you have to set up these tanks, and you have those tankers making routine runs to a water source to do it, whether they're using a hard suction hose or soft sleeve, whatever, to bring water back so that fire could be fought. So you just raised that to a different level. Instead of just water from fire tankers, you're bringing in these
mobile retardant base.
MRB. Yes, great. That's it. MRBs. Yeah. And in the same manner to do the exact same thing so that the aircraft have the ability on an ongoing basis, not having to sit there and just waste fuel. They're ready. They come in, they pick up their load off, and then they refill the load down there and ready for the next aircraft to come in. And I think, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I've not heard of anybody else doing this, let alone doing it at night.
Yeah.
We know the difference in most of America that firefighting is totally different at night for us. But we also have to realize that 80% of America's firefighters, whether they're career volunteer or part pay, are not working in urban areas where they're going to have, you know, 12 engines coming to a structure fire call. They have to make do with maybe one or two engines and maybe a rescue team and just do what they can until they can get some mutual aid to come in or another station from another part of the community to come in. This, I think you're able to leapfrog that because you're doing this in advance. This is part of the plan. It's not something that you're it's not a reaction. It's actually proaction to be prepared for the tasks that are going to be necessary to put out these fires. And the fact that you, as you said, Chief Fennessy, that you've been able to move. And as you said, we've seen IR flying for years in LA, in the greater LA area, in Southern California. It was on the show, it was on Emergency, where a couple of times they were in one of the LA County helicopters and the pilot was using his night vision goggles, which, you know, came from the military in the days in Vietnam, et cetera. And it opens that door so that not only does firefighting not have to stop at night just on because of the manpower, but now you're able to keep working against that fire basically 24/7, as long as the weather itself holds out and allows for flying. And I think that is the major breakthrough that I realized when I watched the show, that this is totally different than anything else I had read in the trades over the years. We see wildfire, we see these articles about it in the trades, but nobody really, to my knowledge, and it might be limited, I have to admit that, but my knowledge, I don't remember seeing anybody else going and being proactive. Yes, we do fire prevention, but proactive at this level to make sure that you can handle these type of fires as quickly and as efficiently and as safely as possible. Because we do know, and folks, if you're really dedicated to this service that we love, is that we lose pilots, good people, and observers who fly with them. We lose them once in a while, who give their lives in protection in the same purpose as we're willing to do when we fight fires or go on a rescue call. We know that there's a risk. And these pilots, and we have to give them those kudos, these pilots are amazing people. And they fly in situations that most pilots will never even see in their lives. But this is what they want to do. And they're good at it. The video that I watched on that Smithsonian show was amazing to see. From start to finish, just the load up, the dropping of the retardant or the water, then quick refill again, and then back again. And it was just a smooth rotation of the aircraft flying and doing what they had to do, whether that scene in that show was just doing the practice drop or doing an actual drop on a working fire. I just found that something that is to me, a major innovation for fighting these fires. And that's why I want to bring you on today, because I want as many people in the fire service to hear about this who may not have heard about it, or maybe just think, well, it's LA County is rich, or LA City is a rich, so they can spend all the money they want. Well, that's not the case, number one. Number two, the firefighters in all four of these counties also go through the same thing we go through on a day-to-day basis. They're no different than us. We all go through life, and life throws us all sorts of frisbees, and sometimes it's a rock, and sometimes it's a boulder, and sometimes it's a burning tree. And the fact is that what this community has done for just the concept of fighting wildfires, major fires, is eye-opening, just to say that, but it doesn't encompass the vastness of this whole new way of thinking to protect our communities and people from these terrible wildfires. And hopefully this concept is going to catch on. Again, not every community can afford to do it at the level that you, four of you, your counties are, but this could be a starting platform for them. They can learn, and then they can start planning for it. And they have great examples to see. So that being said, we'll finish off the segment with, let's talk about how a typical, let's start with how a typical call is dispatched and what it entails and what are the time frames that we're looking at.
Well, I'd like to add a couple of points to what we just discussed before we move on, in that they've been dropping retardant on helicopters for years. That's not the new part. And the reason I wanted to share this point was that for anybody listening in the emergency services, never think you have it all figured out. Always look for that window of opportunity or some way to make your program better. Because that's all we did here. We're just, you know, firefighters trying to make things better. And Chief Fantasy has some magic that he does with everybody and encouraging programs. So that's been very helpful. But the idea of the retardant is normally it would show up 2 to 3 days into the incident. And one of the reasons it's was slow is because they don't have the predetermined locations that we're allowed to set up. That has been a real and remains a key issue with how we're able to operate on the first night. And our goal was to do something about it the first night. Not our focus isn't on waiting until it gets big and then come in. We continually encourage the other agencies to use this right away. It's back to the old volunteer fire concept. When the fire siren goes off, a horn or whatever you have, people rush there and they get there as quickly as possible. It's not a new concept.
Right.
So we're just saying, let's do it at a larger level where we have this massive suppression power that we can apply to the fire. And sometimes we need to cancel them. If we don't need them, we just turn them around. So we're really up on that. And that's the MRB is for that sustained operation. We don't need it right in the beginning while we're setting up the helicopters or dropping water or gel on the fires. Yeah, you can do both. But if the fire continues to grow, that's where the retardant comes into play. So it's a very synchronized event. It's not easy. There's a lot of things that happen that get in the way of it, but that's our goal. Get there quick. And if we have an extended attack fire, we're going to go after it with retardant. But my message to any of the listeners is don't give up what you have. See if there's some way you can improve it. Even if you don't have I've been on a volunteer. I know there's no budget in a volunteer fire department. It's really tough to get along, but never give up that you can make it better.
That's a great point. You know what? I do want to ask a question. With technology as it is, do you folks still use drones to help you? Or is that platform, the administrative helicopter, does that give you everything you need through that?
I'll let Chief Fantasy take that one.
I'm going to toss that to you, man. We do. We use drones. We use small drones, some of the crews or whatever. But right now, you know, there's even posters out there. If you fly them, we can't. Right. And so really it's focused at the public, because one of the challenges is members of the public have these drones. And if they get them airspace that the helicopters and air tankers are operating, obviously that can be a pretty huge issue. So up until probably even now, you're not seeing a lot of mixed airspace or any mixed airspace with drones and fixed wing and fire suppression helicopters. However, I think you're going to see that change. And I know that we're working with a company out of Israel that, you know, has got drones, basically that they're synchronized or whatever, and they recognize the other aircraft. They've got transponders and actually can get on the ground when other aircraft are around or behind rocks and some of those other things. So I think we're going to get there. You know, the aerial supervision platform, and Scotty can talk a little bit more about that, is really key, both from a safety and from a tactical perspective. And it's equipped with pretty much the same gimbal or camera system that the news helicopters have, a very expensive, high-definition camera that not only provides us video, provides us infrared, mapping, all those other things, but can really direct those. Hey, listen, flying at night, flying period, is there's risk to it, right? I mean, it's a hazardous occupation. Scotty and I have been in it for a long time, and we all have friends that, you know, we've gone to, unfortunately, a lot of funerals over the years. Scotty's been involved in accidents. I've been involved in accidents. And so it's one of those things that we obviously take very seriously. You know, these pilots, and you mentioned it, man, they are so skilled, you know, whether they're former military pilots or have been working in logging, vertical reference type flying. The requirements are very high, you know, to become a pilot at LA County or Orange or any of these others. And so, but it is a high risk operation. And we really feel like the aerial supervision platform is a got to have. There's some advantages to flying at night. There's less radio traffic typically. You're not dodging fixed wing air tankers, or, you know, it's easier to deconflict the airspace. But you still are flying under goggles, and they can fatigue you. But I'm gonna toss it over to Chief Jones. I know he's working more closely with him than I am.
Well, yeah, as far as the aerial supervision platform goes, our model was to have it set up where we have a pilot dedicated to flying the aircraft. So that's really important. We feel is that the pilot be totally focused on what he's doing with the aircraft. Then we have what we call a helicopter coordinator. They're qualified as air attack / helicopter coordinator. These are all very highly experienced people. In fact, they've all been through their careers in other agencies and retired, most of them at command level positions. And now they're able to come in and just focus on what we're doing here as aerial supervision. And they're the best that we can find. We think they're the best. There's other people equally good, but these are very, very top end people. And we fly in a Sikorsky S-76. It's a great machine. It's very fast and good visibility. And then we have a sensor operator that sits in the back seat and operates all the cameras. And we have a laser pointer, for example.
Wow.
That's a pretty unique deal. The laser pointer is used so that the supervision platform flies around the fire and identifies places where maybe the retardant went and then the next drop went and there's a gap in the line and we need to patch that up. And they'll just shine that laser down there on the ground so the incoming pilot knows exactly where to drop. Even on NVG, it's hard to identify the retardant line at night. And you can see it, but it's not as easy as it is in daylight. So that's how we make up for that, is with the aerial supervision platform and the laser. So it's all some pretty high-tech stuff. It's really great stuff, but it still takes talented people to make it work. It doesn't work on its own.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah.
That's good. All right. Well, folks, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about, from the initial steps, what happens when a fire is reported, what they do, and we'll learn more about the QRF program right after these words. As always, please stay tuned. The tone sounds and the dispatcher announces, stations 14 and 16, working residential structure. And that was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE. Bunker pants, check. Turnout coat, check. Hood, check. Gloves, check. Escape line, check. SCBA strapped on, you're ready. Paderavi would jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the Red Cross lei, and head for the open front door, where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy is behind you. Crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything! What the hell are you thinking? You see, it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores on your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down, that forces everyone else to change their tasks to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go to. Face peace on.
The physical and mental demands of a firefighter place major stress on our minds and body, and especially our heart. Far too many of our brothers and sisters in the fire and emergency service are lost each year due to cardiac arrest. In fact, statistics show that those of us active in this profession are much more susceptible to cardiac arrest than the general population. Too often, ignoring the warning signs is a fatal decision. Your body will definitely be signaling to you that something is wrong. A feeling that you have never had before. If you don't feel well, don't make it your farewell. Seek medical attention immediately. If someone under your command or in your unit is not feeling well, don't send them home. Don't send them to the bunk hall. Insist they get checked immediately. Let's change the culture in our profession, in our departments, of ignoring the warning signs our bodies are telling us. Visit IAFC.org to learn how.
This message is brought to you by the International Association of Fire Chiefs and this podcaster. As much as we love it, being a first responder is not easy. There's so much we see that we would not want anyone we care about to see it. Yet, we deal with this often on a day-by-day basis. Add on sleep deprivation, overtime shifts, money issues, and more. They all seem to pile up on the plate of life, and many just do not know how to cope with it all. On Tuesday, January 23rd at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll present our webinar, Thrive on Duty, Optimize Your Sleep and Stress. Our presenters include Retired Chief Arjuna George, author of the book Burnt Around the Edges, the producer and host of the Beneath the Helmet podcast. Chief George will share his personal struggle with burnout and overbearing stress and how he was able to free himself from those shackles and now thrives better than ever before. Miss Andy Clark has 30 plus years in the health and wellness industry. She's also married to a police officer who dealt with many of the issues we've mentioned above. Those difficulties worked their way into their home, and it was then that Annie decided to make a change for both of them and help them deal with these issues. She's a certified sleep, stress, and resilience coach and manages both PKI Health and 911lifestyles.com. Tickets are now on sale for $20. They may be slightly higher in Canada. Ticket availability is limited, so be sure to purchase yours right away. Use the link https://bit, that's B as in Bravo, it.ly/T=Thrive(OnD)Duty, and make sure you put Thrive on Duty as one word. Or use the QR code you can see on any of our social media flyer postings. Start your journey to being a better you with us on January 23rd, 2024. Thrive on Duty. Optimize your sleep and stress. Hello and welcome back to this episode of Five Alarm Task Force. Joining me this morning for this very important episode is Chief Brian Fennessy, Chief of the Orange County Fire Authority in Southern California. And joining us also is retired Assistant Chief Scott Jones, who has a huge background also in the fire service and worked with LA County Fire and Rescue. And we are talking about their QRF program, which is made up through four counties: Southern California, LA County, Orange County, Ventura, and was it?
It's just the three counties.
Oh, just LA. The three counties:
LA, Orange, and Ventura. Yep,
Ventura counties. And so we talked about a little bit in the first segment. We're talking about sometimes we see it in the rest of the U.S. that the departments have their ley lines. They have their borders and they don't want to, they know they need mutual aid, but So they don't like somebody on that department in the next town. So I don't want to fight fire with him. Let me go to this place. And that place is, it's, they get the politics in the way. The fact is what these three counties have done is said, the hell with the politics. We have to save the people and the property. And we need the help from the agencies to allow us to do our job. And I think that in and of itself speaks volumes to how the fire service needs to evolve. We have to stop the politicizing of our departments and rather keep focused, as Chief Bruno, the late Chief Bruno taught us, that our job is to take care of Mrs. Smith on her worst possible day, if that worst day for her is just her cat up in the tree. While it may be a frequent flyer for us that we keep going back to her, it means the world to her when we show up and rescue that cat. That's not a life and death situation. But these fires in Southern California, now going up the Pacific Coast, going all the way up to Alaska, what we saw in New Orleans, Colorado, we see in Europe, in the Middle East as well. These don't deal with politics. Fire doesn't give a damn about politics. Fire wants to burn and destroy. That's what it's about. Our job in the fire service is to stop that as quickly and as safely as we possibly can. And this joining of three counties in Southern California to, with that sole goal in mind, is to knock down these fires, prevent their expansion, and save people's lives and property, is their goal. That's what it's about. It's not politics. Yes, does politics enter into it sometimes? Negotiating contracts? Yeah, sure it does. But the concept has nothing to do with politics. It is about doing what we take the oath to. It's just a higher tech way of living up to it. And as Chief Jones said, you know, he was in a volunteer service. I was in a volunteer service. Sometimes you got to hope that the next community is going to come over and answer you and show up to help you fight that structure fire. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And again, why that happens sometimes and doesn't, I don't know. And really, I don't care. We should keep our eye on the goal, which is protect our communities, lives, and property. So, gentlemen, let's now take in this segment, a call comes out. You're notified. I don't even know how you'd be notified that there's a fire that started up and that you have to start getting ready to take it up a notch. So what is the process? How does that happen for the alerting? And then where do we go from there?
Well, I think it, you know, each of our counties have our own, you know, emergency command centers or ECCs, those sorts of things. And the way the mutual aid system is set up here is each county in California is considered an operational area. And a cluster of these operational areas, these counties, are considered regions. So, you know, in our area, Region 1 under the state of California, emergency services is Santa Barbara County, Ventura County, LA County, and Orange County. So all fire agencies within those counties make up Region 1. So if you can imagine, all fires, you know, start local. And so, you know, we, most fire departments here in Southern California have a very robust first alarm response or vegetation fire response, depending on the type of day it is. If it's a high, medium, or low day, we'll kind of dictate what goes out the door. But we push things out the door just on a report of, we don't wait any longer for confirmation that there is a fire. We're going out the door assuming that there is, much like a structure fire. You know, when somebody calls 911 and says, you know, their kitchen's on fire, or whatever, we send the whole boat because, you know, we don't know what we're going to have. So that takes place kind of all on its own. Same time, we have a mountaintop camera linked system. There's probably over 1,000 mountaintop cameras now, real time, that all the dispatch centers are connected to. So if somebody reports a fire somewhere, we don't have in Southern California really a fire detection problem. A lot of emphasis in other parts of this state, remote areas of the state, and certainly throughout the West, where fire detection is perhaps an issue, not a big issue. Any smoke that pops up, you know, somebody on the freeway is going to see, an airplane's going to, I mean, we don't have that. But, you know, it's nice about the cameras is they are confirming that, oh, no, there is smoke in the area. And by what the smoke is doing can tell us quite a bit about what that fire is doing as well. And so we really rely upon the folks on the ground, like Chief Jones said, to really manage the resources that are coming and to recognize that, oh, this might be a fire that can exceed what I have already come into the show. And so it's kind of that process that I know all three of our counties dispatch these Chinooks, you know, like the one behind me, the CH-47 military Chinook that's been converted to firefighting. We each send on our own fires. Really, it's a matter of when those fires present themselves to be, hey, they're going to get away from us, or there's an opportunity to do more. Well, we'll see. You know, if it's Orange County, us request through LA County, you know, the assistance. Or, and Scotty, you can help me in this, you know, it could be that, hey, that fire now is burned through the day, and they're recognizing that, look, this might be an opportunity to fight fire at night and to drop retardant at night. But somebody's got to have that forethought, because as Chief Jones says, it's a pretty major operation to move this mobile retardant base and get set up for that first night. And Chief, maybe you can fill in.
Sure. So what we've seen typically now, our view is we'd rather see all the water dropping helicopters, all three Chinooks, heading out early, especially like Chief Hennessy was doing here this last week. If he had a vegetation fire, he sent the whole force each time. And while that seems reluctant, or maybe a bit of an overkill in some people's view, the fact is, it's very. If you don't do that, you're pound wise, penny foolish, or you're penny wise, pound foolish. Sorry, I had that backwards. He spent a little bit of money up front on rotor time to get the resource there because he doesn't want it to get established. So that's a change from how big aircraft have been ordered in the past. So what we do now is let's take the fire Ventura had the other day. They started with the fire. They had their helitanker on it and their normal aircraft. And they're busy defending structures. I mean, you know, it's the ICs have a ton of things going on and coming at them. And we have AirTAC coming with CAL FIRE, and they bring air tankers. And that's kind of our normal routine. And it's very busy. But it wasn't until the afternoon that they could see this was going to go beyond their, you know, what they had on hand, as the chief talked about. And at night, when the sun goes down, those air tankers are going to leave. So they ordered us in the afternoon, and they gave us time to go out to the fire several hours to set up the retardant base. So the timing of all that was very good. But there's a lot of things that movement at that point, because the chiefs, he hasn't covered their role. Their role, those three fire chiefs are always in touch with each other. And they collaterally make the decision whether to send them here. And they all agree to do it, and it happens very fast. But I know the folks on the ground don't know, but these three chiefs have a great working relationship, and that's what it takes to make it work. Because, and he'll explain later more about just, you know, how we work with, interact with CAL FIRE and their role in all of this. So it's kind of a complex system. In fact, I think it's very, very complex, but. Through efforts, you know, by Chief Hennessy and the other chiefs, and working with CAL FIRE, you know, they're making it better. So when that call goes out, I'm on the phone alerting our people and making sure they're going to the right location and where I want them to go. And I must do 200 phone calls in 2 days. It's In fact, I have trouble getting to the fires because everybody texts nowadays, and I got to pull over the side of the road and text, you know. And so it's pretty busy. It's just everybody wants to make sure they get to the right place on the right frequencies. There's a lot of detail that goes into what we're doing. Who do they check in with and so forth. So it's just once it starts, it's a real busy time throughout the fire. And then the next day, there's a lot of complexities to closing it out. So a general response for us, just my job, my duties, and anybody connected to it. We were on this last fire from, oh gosh, 3-4 in the afternoon until it was out the next morning when the sun came up, but we still had things to finish up. So any fire I go to, generally 3 days of work, right, just to deal with the details. And I know the chief's doing his whole, he's being a little humble here because he's really back cracking the whip on everybody else to give us the support we need.
Well, for something this vast, it's amazing that you've been able to get all the cogs. They may turn slowly, but you got all the cogs fitting together. And that's really what we should admire, is that you've kind of broken the mold and shown how well, when you dedicate yourself to a goal in fire attack or fire prevention, fire mitigation, when you put yourselves in that frame of mind that this is our goal, we're going to work together to do it, that changes everything. And I think that the example of the three counties working together, and that the chiefs are always in touch with each other, I think is a great example for the rest of the American and the Canadian fire services to see, because we can work together and we can be successful. We've all been to calls where the end of the call did not deliver what we were hoping for. And that's just the nature of the beast. But the fact is that the three counties here in Southern California have made such a great example of how we can overcome the differences and work together to carry out the mission of protecting lives and property. Because whether it's winter going through the ice in the northern part of our country, it's working the coastal areas, or it's on the West Coast, there are always emergencies. And, 99% of the time, they dial the same three numbers, 911. And that's when we get the call and we have to act. And sometimes we let our egos get in the way of our duties. And I think that this is a great example where it was the safety of the people in these three counties and the overall concept of keeping your forest, your wildlands, keeping the animals, the wildlife safe as well to the best you can. Because again, as the show Emergency showed on displayed on several occasions, that how these fires impact families, the agricultural communities. Everybody looks at LA, the greater LA area, as all city built up. If you've never been to Southern California and gone all the way from Los Angeles all the way down to San Diego, you see this beautiful mix of area of the Pacific Coast. And it's not all built up cities and buildings. There's plenty of rural areas and suburban areas where there are hundreds of thousands of people. And they depend, when these fires occur, they depend on this team to mitigate those fires to the best of their ability. So, Chief Hennessy, let's move on then with you to follow up with the Chief Jones. So we've started that first level, and we got that first night, and we're set for that. Where do we go when that night is not totally successful, and we see we're going to carry over into the daylight again? Now the winds are going to pick up maybe a little bit more. We know that some of these fires can produce their own weather. We've all seen that on news stories as well. So how does that affect as you're on a continuous, on a larger fire? What kicks in at that point?
So it builds, and I'm glad you shared that. Down here, there are multiple agencies involved in any of these responses. Sometimes initially, as Chief Jones mentioned, just on initial attack in our counties, CAL FIRE is going to send an air attack and two air tankers. It's just part of the package. And it's not uncommon for either of our counties, well, even Ventura County, the Forest Service will be involved. It could be a Forest Service helicopter. It could be, Forest Service air attack. So really you're looking at, the federal, state, and local government all responding, to the same fire most of the time. And as they continue to grow, well, you're going to see more state resources. You're going to see more federal and, of course, more local government. So the coordination of all that is pretty significant. You could literally have hundreds of people assigned to a fire, you know, within the first hour, you know, or two, and thousands perhaps, you know, midway through. I mean, it just grows exponentially that fast. And that's where you end up. As much as we work closely with the state and the federal folks, the Forest Service and CAL FIRE, there can be challenges in terms of you know, policies. We each have our own policies. Now, we know what they are, and we've you know, modified them to where, you know, we're basically all operating, you know, on the same page. What we've noticed, or what we've experienced, I should say, and I'm going to take a leap here. Certainly, Chief Jones was in the fire service before I was, but, you know, just the advent of paramedicine, you talked a lot about emergency and all that. That was not something that just everybody said, oh, this is great, let's do it. I mean, it took a while for it to spread out. There was a lot of resistance by a lot of firefighters that were like, no, we fight fire. This is what we do. EMS is, you're one of them. I mean, even, you know, when I was in San Diego in the early 90s, as paramedics started to become more, you know, we got more and more of them, it was almost like they were ostracized. Oh, you're the paramedic, you go sit over there, you know, even though there were firefighters. Now there's none of that. Well, we're experiencing much of the same with this program. It is new. And so anything new you bring forward is visible and as large as it is, there's, I think, a tendency within the fire service not to be necessarily, let's just say, early adopters. And so, you know, whether it's people who really want you to fail, whether it's ego, whatever it may be. And so the proof's in the pudding. And so getting, you know, the aircraft used and mobilized and operated like the vision was, took a bit of time. I think that what pushed us over were the big fires up in Northern California in 2021. In million acre fires that were burning for weeks on ends that were destroying towns. And at the time, we in Southern California were experiencing damp, foggy weather. You know, I mean, we were not going to get a fire down here. And so the three chiefs, myself and the other two chiefs, offered to send the QRF up to Northern California the day after an entire town was destroyed. We just felt like on our calls, like, man, here we are sitting on these, I mean, amazing resources, and they don't have enough up north. How do we not offer them up if we're not looking at fire weather down here? And so we did. And, you know, the QRF was mobilized up north. Chief Jones, talk about those, you know, 3 days, you can multiply that by a lot. I mean, if you can imagine an operation, because we're talking about, again, 24 people assigned to each base, right? Just for the Chinooks. You got the S-76. You have the fire department people, the ground vehicles, all to mobilize at once. Now you got to get hotels for everybody. You got to find a landing here. You've got to, I mean, and really, Chief Jones was our older guy up there to manage all that. That was a huge endeavor. And as hard as it was, I think it did open the eyes of, you know, not only the Forest Service, but certainly CAL FIRE. And I think it'd be fair to say that I don't think those agencies were really thrilled about our mobilization up there. And, you know, we did make the first water drops at night in Northern California, the first retardant drops at night by these helicopters up there. And the newspapers and the people up north, they loved what we brought up there. We later found out that what had been communicated, at least through the federal system for many years, was that night flying was a Southern California thing. There's no place for night flying in Northern California, anywhere else in the West. This is specifically a Southern California thing. And unbeknownst to us, we thought it was really odd. There was absolutely no reason that we couldn't do what we do in Southern California up north. And in fact, in many cases, it might even be a little bit easier as you're not dealing with, you know, a lot of ambient light distractions or other aircraft and those sorts of things. So we certainly learned a lot from that experience. I think it did force those other agencies to have to acknowledge that this is a resource that they should be using. But I'd be lying if I told you that it wasn't something that has just been readily adopted everywhere within our fire service. But that's been our experience. I think to Chief Jones's point, we've been doing this for 3 years. And the longer we continue to do it, the more it becomes embraced. Once an agency or an organization actually sees it for the first time, they go, oh, man, you know, we're going to do that again. I don't know, Chief Jones, you mobilized with these folks. You're living with it more probably than I am.
Well, starting what you just said, I'm just a huge fan of the CH-47. These big Chinooks have been a game changer. And out here in our most of our all of our departments now are flying the S-70s. We call them Firehawks, and they carry 1,000 gallons. And boy, we were all excited when we got those. LA County got into that program 28 years ago, I think. And Cal Fire has now started building a Firehawk program. But so the Firehawk took the 412, which is called the medium helicopter that drops approximately 350 gallons of water, which was our workhorse for years and years and years. And then the Firehawk came along, and it was slow to come in. And LA County had to do a lot of adjusting to make the program work. It was costly and so forth, but everybody realized that was a fast machine. It carried over twice what the 412 did, and it just really outpaced them. Well, the same thing has happened here with the Chinook. The Chinook has taken the Firehawk and displaced it a little bit, kind of like the Firehawk to the 412 comparison. The Chinook is, it takes three Firehawks to make one Chinook. So you think about the exponentially different delivery system that we have flying at night. This is just an enormous improvement in our system. In fact, adding one Chinook to each of the three counties essentially doubled their initial attack suppression power. Wow. Just that alone has been a huge accomplishment. So I kind of forgot what the question was now because I got all fired up over the helitankers. But
you're talking about dropping, you know, three helitankers working on a fire. You're dropping 9,000 gallons of water or retardant as the three of them pass over their designated areas. There's no other way that could have happened prior to enlisting the Chinooks. There was just no capability for that. And now we've taken, you know, even I remember, again, going back to the TV show, the helicopters were the old, not the Cobras, the
205 Hueys.
Right, the old Hueys, right. And they would drop, you know, probably 250 gallons, maybe three from those tanks. They always had an engine company set up to refill them, like that. But when you take maybe 200 gallons or 350 gallons, and you have now the ability to drop 9,000 gallons within 3 or 4 minutes at that same area, it's a game changer. Automatically, it's a game changer. You know, you can light one match, and you just have a little flame. You light the whole book of matches up, and now you got a bigger fire on your hand. Just turn around to putting out that fire. If you have just the one little Dixie cup of water, you can put out maybe that one match, but maybe you need a bigger glass to put out the whole match packet. So it's amazing to see what not only the new capabilities that you have, but how efficient they are because of what they can do. And they have the ability to spot drop, I guess is what it's called. It's not just making a big run. Like everybody sees the DC-10 was converted. They see that fly over and things like that. But that's kind of, yes, they practice and they have a special zone, but that's kind of like a Hail Mary when you drop that. Whereas the Chinooks, according from what I'm hearing, and please tell me if I'm wrong, is that you really are spot dropping. You can say, I want those 9,000 gallons in this ravine in the next 6 minutes or 7 minutes.
Well, let me give you an example on the South Fire in Ventura. And we don't want to discount the small 412s And of course, the firehawk is a tremendous tool. And you have to remember that the firehawk is a multi-purpose tool. We use it for hoist rescue and transferring people to hospitals and transferring troops to the top of the hill to cut line. So I'm not underselling the firehawk. It's a tremendous, tremendous. It was a real game changer. This the Chinooks are yet another game changer in a specialized arena to move the water. So the fire departments that have the 412s and the Firehawks have what they need because they have to all year round use those for different operations. We're focusing on the fire suppression. So we have a very focused unit. So on the fire in Ventura the other night, we had been dropped. We dropped over, oh gosh, over 62,000 gallons of retardant. And I think they dropped 180,000 gallons of water between the three helicopters overnight. So we put down over 200,000 gallons of product on the fire. So the fire was blew up and was heading towards some houses in the dark. And so the pilots and the helico decided to switch to water because there was a golf course nearby and they were able to go dip out of the pond. Man, you're talking about putting water on fire. These guys just hammered it. You know, I couldn't tell you how many gallons went down, but they really checked that fire because the firefighters, we got to also keep in mind here, part of our programs focused on firefighter safety, because we know wherever that fire is going, there's going to be a truck down there with people in it trying to keep the fire off the houses, and we lose people there. So our helco switched over to the water and just pounded that fire and made a huge difference. So having the versatility of the aircraft and how much you can carry, I mean, there's just something about the extra water that can be delivered to your point over one area. In the past, it would have taken three drops from a firehawk to try to get it. They can hover over that thing and dump all 3,000 gallons straight down on it, and that knocks fire down. So it's just something we've never seen before, and we're still learning about what we should do with it. Now, another thing that happens that is difficult in these wind-driven events is the pilots are flying, and when they pull the button to drop water, it's not just our guys, it's the Firehawks and the 412s are the same. They have to calculate. They're flying this machine in 60-mile-an-hour winds, which is challenging, at ground level, looking out for terrain and wires, and they're trying to figure out when to push that button to get that water to drift into the wherever the fire is, because the wind owns it after that.
Right.
And just a huge, huge, huge challenge. So sometimes it looks like they're not being productive, but that's just how it is under those conditions. So they really get good at figuring out how far off the fire they need to be. So when they punch the load out, whether it's a long trail drop or it's that salvo drop that you just mentioned, they have to, you know, calculate that. So it's a lot of skill. And hats off to those pilots.
Right. Plus the skill they need is a lot of people don't realize that when they take off, when they're loaded, they have a certain weight. And once they let that cargo go, that retardant of water go, but the aircraft is still working at, initially at that weight it needed, at the level it needed to lift all that weight off. Suddenly you get that drop and then there's a almost like a backdraft, for lack of a
better word. Yes, there's a surge.
Right.
Yeah, and actually where they have the most trouble is when they've loaded. So they're always calculating their fuel load compared to the water. In the beginning, they don't carry 3,000 gallons. No helicopter does. It's always a trade-off between how much fuel you're carrying, and they try to carry as much fuel as they can.
Sure.
And then as that fuel gets consumed, they can carry more and more water. And so it's when they're hovering over that tank with a high wind buffering them around, they've got a snorkel that goes down into the tank. And the tank, I think, is 12 feet in diameter. And so that's a pretty small target when you're having a 50,000-pound aircraft above it in a 40, 50-mile-an-hour ground-level wind speeds. And then they're concentrating on filling it. And when they get the tank to the level they think is right, they start to lift off. Well, sometimes they find out, whoops, we took too much on. It's too heavy. They just don't have enough to get through that wind. So they have to punch part of it off.
Right.
Now, in the other helicopters, when they hit the button, they lose at least half their load, but the Chinook can break their load into five segments. So they can drop 600 gallons, 600 gallons, 600
Oh,
gallons.
wow.
Yeah. So
That's.
they're able to punch off a little bit of that load and save the rest. They just have to salvage a part of it and move on. But then when you're over the fire, they can either salvage drop all the load, or they can do a trail drop. Can be over 1,000 feet long, or they can do these five salvos.
Just amazing. Chief Hennessy, I'd like we talked about CAL FIRE a little bit, and just in case we have viewers and listeners who don't know, they've heard the term CAL FIRE and they think it's a fire department in and of itself. Could you explain a little bit to them what CAL FIRE is and how it works within the state, please?
Sure, they are largely a fire department within themselves. They're the full name is the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Used to be known as CDF, the California Department of Forestry. Back in the, I want to say, mid-90s, they switched to CAL FIRE to better represent more of their all-hazard mission. They are the largest fire organization in the state of California. In many counties and areas, especially up north, they are the primary or the larger fire organization. In Southern California, Riverside County, which is a large county that we share a border with, is managed by the Riverside unit, but Riverside County contracts with CAL FIRE for fire protection services, and it's not just wildfire, it's all levels of fire service. There are six counties of the 58 counties in California that are known as contract counties. Ourselves, LA County, Kern, Ventura, Santa Barbara, and Marin up north are contract counties. What that means is that many, many years ago, and I think in LA County's case, probably over 100 years ago, the areas that the state is responsible for, what we call state responsibility area or SRA, is contracted to the counties for that fire protection. So the six counties, again, we receive money from the state of California, the state forestry service, for lack of better words. You got the Florida's got its own forestry service. Most every state does, and that's what they are. They just happen to be extremely large. They operate, I don't know, a couple dozen S2 air tankers. They've got, as Chief Jones said, they procured a dozen now. I think it's 15 or 16 Fire Hawks are still in the process of taking delivery of those that are placed throughout the state. They are getting into the night firefighting business, and so we work, closely with them. They're a great organization to work with, and it's nice. I think it's nice as a fire chief to be a contract county, not only because we receive money to fund some of the resources we have to protect their land, but they're a great partner in that, should we experience a large fire here, and well, we manage very well our own fires and can, they bring with them a depth of not only capability, but buying and logistics and procurement that would be difficult for any local government agency. So when we have a fire that we think is now complex enough to require an incident management team, it's really easy to go to the state director at CAL FIRE and say, look, we'd like, to have an IMT assigned to this because we're going to get more people assigned to manage that. And when it comes to cost, I mean, you can imagine these large fires are costing millions and millions of dollars. And to apportion that and to figure out, cost sharing and those sorts of things, it gets very complex. And so they're a great resource, I think, for all of us to have up and down the state. But we're very close with them, and they're obviously very aware of this program, and we'll maybe be a little bit slow to adopt. We're seeing that increase a bit further. So it's a great relationship we have with them.
That's great to hear. And I think you folks have established you're the really the flagstaff for the rest of the country to see that multiple diverse communities can come together with the same goals and the same aims and work together, work with logistics, take care of logistics, take care of apportionment, assignments, et cetera, working together as a team, as opposed to vying with each other. Because again, as we said several times in this interview, we have one job when we take that oath, and that's to protect the people and property of our communities to the best of our ability. And I think that the pact that the three counties in California have is a shining example of what we can do when we decide to put our heads together and work together, as opposed to focusing only on differences and things like that. Threading of hoses and the pumpers, et cetera. Yeah, we may not all agree on which to turn left, to turn right, but the fact is it's all part of the same goal, and that's to live up to our oaths. I can't thank you both enough for spending time with us this morning and explaining this amazing program. I would love to see it have more exposure in national media, because I think all departments should be aware of what can be done. I'm not saying they're all going to do this to this extent,
sure,
but it is a great example of how departments can work and communities, entire counties can work together with each other. And it's not going to solve every problem between the counties, that's for sure. But we always share one problem, and that's protection of life and property. No matter which county you're in, whether you're in California or Northern Maine, makes no difference. We all have the same goal in mind. We all do this because we all feel a calling to do this, whether we're career, volunteer, WUI. It's what we feel we want to do in the community where we serve or where we live. And I wish you all the success and continued success with the growth. And I have no doubt that you're both going to be busy doing a lot of consulting with other departments, not just in the state of California, but hopefully other states that deal with these kind of problems at this level will see, wait a second, you know what? We can look what they're doing there. If they can do something like that, we can probably do something. Might not be as to that level, but we can work together. And when we have a major fire, we can put our resources together and help each other out.
You know, Steve, I don't want to forget this topic. I'm sorry to jump in on here, but you said it several times that I think it's really important to pass on. And that is, I've been to fires all over the country when I worked on national teams and throughout our own department. And one of the things I found was that when you talk to the people in the community, you're a firefighter. That's it. They don't know where you're from. Man in the moon, they think it's all one big fire department. They don't care. When you show up, you're representing whatever that local community standards are. So we have an obligation to each other to not only do the best we can, but realize we're representing our whole industry. No matter where you go, you represent the industry at large.
Absolutely. There's nothing better than putting it that way. Gentlemen, again, my sincere thanks and appreciation for your time, for your service, everything you're doing to help the people in Southern California, and then sharing it wherever it's needed in the state. And I think, again, this is the example that the rest of the country has to see, that we are not separate entities when it comes to our service. We all do the same thing. We just do it in different places, different situations, but we all do the same thing. We do the same job, and we do it for the same reason, the passion and love we have for serving the people of our communities. So thank you for doing what you did before I even heard of you, and what you've done for the people in Southern California and going up through the state. And as I said, I hope and pray that this will be a great example for other fire services throughout this country, in Canada, and even other countries, to see that, you know what, when push comes to shove, we just get together, we do our job to the very best of our ability, because that's who we are, and that's what we committed our lives to. And so this was wonderful. This is even better than I envisioned it when I first invited you, Chief, but this has been so informative, And I just really can't say thank you enough for it. So we sincerely appreciate all your efforts and all your service, not just to your communities, but to America and what it stands for when you guys stand up and do this kind of terrific work together. Folks, if you're watching the video, that will be the end of it. If you're listening to the audio, well, you know there will be a few spots, and then we'll be back with a few more portions of the show. But to our guests, Chief Hennessy and Chief Jones, thank you so very much for joining us, taking time from busy schedule. I was just waiting for that phone to ring that it was going to be, oh, we got an incident, and you're going to have to leave. But
no,
thankfully,
it worked out.
Yeah, it all worked out well. Stay safe. And thank very you. Best wishes for a safe and a very joyous holiday season to
thank
you
both.
Thanks
thank for you having folks. Us.
It's our pleasure. Thank you very much. And folks, we'll be back very soon with more 5 Alum Task Force. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to 5 Alum Task Force.
Remember when you were a young boy or girl and someone bullied or teased you? Where do you most often turn? Like many of us, you turn to your family. If you're a first responder, you probably no longer worry about those childhood problems. But there are plenty more that can affect us. Lack of sleep, the tragedy and horror we often see, even life's everyday stumbling blocks, like family illness, money, job problems, and more. So where do you turn now? Your gut reaction might be to keep it to yourself and not tell anyone about the hell you're going through. However, that's not going to help you or anyone else. Instead, you could start with your second family, someone you work with at the firehouse, on the ambulance, or at the station. You spend a lot of time with them, and most of them understand many of the problems you're dealing with. Reach out to a coworker or an officer you trust, speak to clergy at your house of worship, or contact your SISM team. Don't keep it inside, gnawing away at you. That's not good for you or anyone around you. Know that there are people who stand ready to listen to you and help you without passing judgment. Remember, to carry out your oath to protect life and property, the first life you have to care for is your own. Brought to you by 5 Alarm Task Force, along with the Critical Incident Stress Management Team in your area, close by and confidential.
Our good friend, Captain Mike Daly, wanted us to let you know that the next semester of the Fire Behavior College is scheduled to begin on Wednesday, February 7th, 2024 at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information regarding our FESHE-approved curriculum, you can go to the website at Kill the Flashover, or you can go to this YouTube link, https://www.youtube.com/watch, WATCH, a lowercase v as in Victor, equals F as in Foxtrot, P as in Peter, L as in Lincoln, X as in X-ray, F as in Foxtrot, K as in Kilo, the numeral 2, and in lowercase, W is in whiskey, H is in hotel, and K as well. Now, any questions, reach out to info@killtheflashover.com, and they hope to see you in class next semester. If you have any questions, contact us at dalmatprod@outlook.com, and we'll help you there too. Thanks for tuning in. Hope to see you there. Hi, this is Steve. Well, here we are, the mid of the month of December. Hanukkah is just finishing up, and Christmas and New Year's are right around the corner. A great time for most people, but not all. As you know, since 2020, when we established our nonprofit corporation, we've had one motto and one goal in mind, and that is to reach out with financial assistance to our brothers or sisters and or their families when they find themselves in dire need. Now, we are proud of the fact that up till now, we've donated just over $6,000 and probably over 95% of that money went to the families of brothers who made the ultimate sacrifice. We've also helped other firefighters who have been injured on duty because they need help too. Just that little starter, that little bit to help us help them. However, it's difficult to admit though all the work that we've been doing in promoting our program and its uniqueness is that in the 3 years, we've only received maybe a half dozen donations through our web portal, our donation page on our website. That's kind of disappointing, to be honest. We work hard here to bring the podcast to you, find our guests, interview them, record it, edit it, both audio and video, as most of you know. And all we ask in return is no money for us. It's money that goes to our foundation account. And it's from that account that every penny we use to help our brothers and sisters comes from. This is important to us. This is one of our ways of giving back to those of you who listen in your time of need. And you don't even have to tell us that you're in need. We have our ways of finding out. And then we rush to help as quickly as we can. We have the webinar that you heard about earlier on the podcast coming up in January. And that helps us. That's a big help for us. But we're just a little perplexed that with all the listeners we have around the world, we've been in 42 countries at our last count. No one, or very, very few, has reached out to make that donation. Injuries and worse don't happen to firefighters just during the holiday season. Just like regular folks, we have our ups and downs, good days, bad days, mediocre days, really crappy days, and wonderful days. But that doesn't mean that an injury or line of duty death won't occur because we have a good day. So this is the first time this year we're really asking you to help us. We need to beef up our reserves to continue to be able to support our brothers and sisters and or their families if and when they find themselves in dire need. The money in the account does not go anywhere else. It's not used on anything for operations, for the podcast itself, the equipment, the broadband service, etc. None of that comes from the foundation account. Every penny of the foundation account is spent to help a brother or sister firefighter and or their family. That was maybe the second oath that we took after becoming firefighters. And my three terrific helpers, board members, on a volunteer basis, retired Battalion Chief Andy Starnes, who also heads up the wonderful company Inside Training LLC that we talk about frequently, and my other good friend Nick Higgins of the Firehouse Tribune, the author of The Five-Tool Firefighter, The Five-Tool Firefighter Workbook. We discuss every issue that's presented to us with a passing or injury to a brother or sister firefighter. Our goal when we started 3 years ago was to raise enough funds that we could help our brothers and sisters in blue and our brothers and sisters in EMS, because we're not the only first responders out there, and lots of them need help. So we ask of you this year before the 31st of the month, and remember, if and when you do make a donation, you may be able to claim that as a tax exemption because we are an IRS certified not-for-profit corporation, certified by the state of Florida as a nonprofit corporation. You'll have to check with your accountant to see if it'll work for you, but for most people, a donation to a nonprofit is tax deductible. So please, this holiday season, reach out like $2, $5, $10, and if you're really a sport, $20. You don't know how far that will go for us just to get a bunch of those come in. We don't need $1,000 grants. Yeah, we would like them. Sure, absolutely. But we're just meat and potatoes. We just want to have enough money to help our own and then maybe expand to other first responders. But we can't do it by ourselves. We can't do it just through webinars. Please, if you are a first responder, especially if you're a firefighter, and you listen to this show, and you listen to the wonderful guests we bring, just like our guest today, the chief of Orange County, California Fire Authority, and his former assistant chief with LA County Fire and Rescue. Those are pretty big names to have on a podcast. So, please help us, and we wish you and yours a very happy, safe, and joyous holiday season. And that's my view. Hi, this is Steve. If you're looking for a holiday gift for a firefighter, especially a volunteer firefighter, but good for all firefighters, I have my book that I wrote a few years ago about how I wound up becoming a firefighter, even though I planned to be a rabbi. I was a volunteer firefighter, but still, not a lot of us in there, especially those who want to be rabbis or principals of religious schools. But you can find my book on Amazon. It's electronic edition only. And you can find it. The name of it is Fish Out of Water, Two Jewish Guys in a Deep South Firehouse. It sells for $2.99, and all the net proceeds from the sale, I donate to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. So it makes for a great present, inexpensive, fun reading, good reading too, and it makes a great gift for the holidays. Again, the name of the book is Fish Out of Water, Two Jewish Guys in a Deep South Firehouse. It's available on Amazon. Just search for it on the Amazon homepage. Thanks for listening. Happy holidays to all.
We're really glad to have you listening to 5 Alarm Task Force. But we also want you to know that there are some other terrific fire service podcasts available. Here's the short list. Beneath the Helmet with Chief Arjuna George. Students of the Game with Danny Beauvais. B-Shifter with Chief John Vance, Josh Bloom, and Nick Brunicini. The Professional Brotherhood with Chief Brian Soller. The Five-Tool Firefighter with Nick Higgins of the Firehouse Tribune. Station Talk with Assistant Chief Tom Marciano. Flow and Vent. DTFF, Down to Fight Fire, British Columbia Volunteers. Better Every Shift with Aaron Zamzo. Firefighter Success with Captain Jim Moss. Code 3, the Firefighters Podcast. Make Do with Nick Peppard and Sean Duffy. Getting Salty. Fit to Fight Fire. Remember, to be a great firefighter, you must be always willing to learn. This message is brought to you by 5 Alarm Task Force Corp. One mission, one family. First responders helping each other.
Did you know that 90% of American communities are served by volunteer fire departments? And that many of those departments are actively looking for more volunteers? When you hear those sirens, do you say to yourself, "Wish I could do that"? If you have the drive to serve, you can be a volunteer too. Volunteer and combo departments are always looking for new recruits. You'll be trained in the latest firefighting and rescue techniques and protecting your community at the same time. You will be joining the ranks of over 1 million men and women who serve their cities and towns, protecting lives and property. Did you know that the founder of the first volunteer fire department was Benjamin Franklin? If old Ben can do it, so can you. Drop by your local fire department and introduce yourself. You just might know some of the folks already there. Before you know it, those volunteers will be like family. Anyone can be a volunteer. Sure, it takes time and effort, but in your heart, you'll realize that it's all worth it. Want more information? Contact your local fire department or visit makemeafirefighter.org. Alternate? Did you know that 7 out of 10 firefighters in the U.S. are volunteers? And the number of volunteer firefighters is declining every year. Most American fire companies are working to recruit new members. When you hear those sirens, do you say to yourself, "Wish I could do that"? If you If you have the drive to serve, you can be a volunteer too. Volunteer fire departments are always looking for new recruits. You'll be trained in the latest firefighting and rescue techniques, as well as emergency medical services to protect your community. Volunteers are also needed to help with fundraisers, conduct fire safety programs, and pitch in around the fire station. Drop by your local fire department and introduce yourself. You just might know some of the folks already there. Before you know it, those volunteers will be like family. Anyone can be a volunteer. Sure, it takes time and effort, but in your heart, you'll realize that it's all worth it. Want more information? Contact your local fire department or visit makemeafirefighter.org. Presented by the National Volunteer Fire Council and 5 Alarm Task Force.
And that wraps this episode of 5 Alarm Task Force, brought to you by 5 Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission, first responders helping each other. We'd like to thank our guests, Chief Brian Fennessy and retired Assistant Chief Scott Jones, for joining us to discuss the QRF, the Quick Response Force for Southern California. Did you know you can find us and subscribe to us on all the top podcast platforms? Just search for 5 Alarm Task Force. We also want to thank our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, the Firehouse Tribune, and LifeScan Wellness Centers, as well as our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Thin Red Line Decon, Hassle Alert, Pry Guy Levers and Estabars, Silver Arrow Coaching and Consulting, Crackle Magazine, the EFT Corporation, Health KPA, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a suggestion for a show, please drop us a line to info@5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at 5 Alarm Task Force, on Facebook at facebook.com/5, A as in Apple, T as in Tango, F as in Foxtrot, C as in Charlie. And on YouTube, please subscribe to our channel, 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. Stay up to date with all the news about our podcast, a new nonprofit foundation, and our blog on our website, www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and let's make sure everyone goes home.